And it's time for It Says in the Papers with Angus Cox.
Lockdown gamble as stores set to open 3 weeks early is the main headline on the front of the Irish Independent. The paper says the Cabinet is expected to sign off on a major acceleration of the government roadmap for easing restrictions after the National Public Health Emergency Team gave the green light to allow major retail outlets with on-street entrances to reopen from Monday. Under phase two of the plan, only small retail outlets were due to open next week. The Cabinet is also expected to sign off on an extension to the temporary wage subsidy scheme until the end of the summer. That's according to the Irish Times. The paper reports the special COVID-19 unemployment payment is also set to be extended until the end of August and that it will be split into two bands, with those earning less than €200 receiving €203, while people earning above €200 would get the current €350 weekly payment. The Irish Examiner says a 1947 law could be used to tackle lockdown house parties after Chief Medical Officer Tony Houlihan expressed concerns about such gatherings. Owen English and Neil Michael write that the concern comes after a tense confrontation in Cork City yesterday between two men and the occupants of a house where there was clear evidence of a recent house party. The house on Glasheen Road is close to where residents first raised complaints last weekend about what they described as Magaluf and J1-style house parties in the area. The paper quotes trainee solicitor Sarah McNulty, who says the Health Act of 1947, which creates a general legal duty to take precautions against infecting others with disease, could be used to address the issue. The Act, she says, gives health officials the power to enter any premises to investigate suspected breaches. Separately, the Examiner reports Black Lives Matter protests due to take place in Cork and Dublin in the coming days have been called off over fears organisers may face prosecution. Jess Casey writes that it comes as Gardaí are investigating the organisers of the Black Lives Matter protest in Dublin, which saw thousands take to the streets on Bank Holiday Monday, adding that holding such events is currently prohibited under COVID-19 restrictions. Yesterday it was pictures of Madeleine McCann featuring prominently on the front pages. Today it's the prime suspect in her 2007 disappearance. The Irish Sun reports police homed in on the man who has a history of child sex abuse after he told someone in a pub, "I snatched her." The Irish Daily Mail says the suspect had been on the police radar for more than two decades, while the Irish Daily Mirror reports police in Germany, where the man is currently in jail, believe Madeleine is dead. There's plenty of analysis of government formation talks across titles, with the focus on the potential role of independent TDs. In the Irish Independent, Hugh O'Connell writes Michael Lowry and Verona Murphy are among a group of regional independents who are open to backing a coalition. While in a comment piece in the same paper, John Downing says it was Jackie Healy-Ray who created the template for independence to make the most of a government deal through the concessions he gained for his Kerry constituency by agreeing to back the Fianna Fáil Progressive Democrat coalition in 1997. Meanwhile, there's a call for urgency with regard to the conclusion of talks in the editorial in The Times. It highlights the need for the Oireachtas to pass important votes on criminal laws and COVID supports by the end of June, adding the country needs a government with a mandate and it needs one immediately. They must make the best deal they can and get on with it. The talking has gone on for long enough, it concludes.
The government is today expected to sign off on the next phase of reopening the country, with the additional decision to allow large shops with street access to open their doors from Monday, 3 weeks ahead of schedule. The move follows a recommendation from the National Public Health Emergency Team, which says the number of new cases of COVID-19 is continuing to decline. At yesterday's briefing, though, the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, said there were some public health concerns in relation to the holding of house parties and other indoor gatherings, which he said are not recommended.
I know a lot of focus has been on some of the external and public gatherings on beaches and platforms and so on dart stations and such places. And those give us cause for concern. But it's the unseen, I think, activity in ordinary houses. Very easy to understand. But we're really not at a point where we think that kind of activity is something that we can recommend. So that's just one example of continuing concern that we would have around where public behaviour, if you like, is getting ahead of where our advice is.
Also at yesterday's NPHET briefing, Professor Philip Nolan, who's chair of the Epidemiological Modelling Group, said the low number of cases now being detected of the virus made it difficult to estimate how the disease is spreading in the population.
With such low prevalence of disease, we've been monitoring the reproduction number of this disease, the effective reproduction number in our society for several weeks now. And the number of cases gets very, very low. It's very difficult to estimate how the disease is spreading in the population. So it's good news that it's hard to estimate what the reproduction number is. We still are confident that it is significantly below one. So the measures that people have taken to ensure when they are coming in contact with other people that they're not transmitting the virus remain effective. It's possible that the reproduction number is a little bit higher this week than it was the last week. If that's the case, it's marginal. As I say, it's difficult to estimate under these circumstances. So we're looking at a reproduction number somewhere between 0.4 and 0.7, safely below 1. Our best estimate of what it was last week is around 0.6, and we're confident that it remains significantly below 1.
Professor Philip Nolan, let's talk to our correspondent Sinead Crowley. Sinead, perhaps we can begin with that issue, the R number, which we've been hearing about so much now in the last number of weeks and months. Just remind us of why it's so important and why there's that crucial focus on keeping it below 1.
Yeah, this number relates to how the virus is transmitted in the community. And when it went to 0.5, I thought, you know, it was explained at the time and it made a lot of sense that that means that two people are only passing it to one person. So if that trend would continue, then the virus would effectively burn out within the community. And we've been watching that 0.5 figure for a couple of weeks. Now, as you heard, yesterday it was said to be between 0.4 and 0.7, and that sounded like an increase. And I suppose those of us who aren't experts but have been watching carefully felt it sounded like an increase. But Professor Nolan did say it was a marginal increase. He's made the point before that actually the numbers are now so low that it's difficult to be 100% accurate when you're looking at these numbers. But he seems certainly satisfied that it was well below 1. And obviously a 1 R number would mean that one person was passing it to another person. And once you got above that, then you would be looking at growth that they don't want to see. But he seemed confident enough. I mean, he gave a lot of statistics at the briefing last night, and you can see that the trends are definitely downwards. For example, the number of cases confirmed per day, 16th of April was 559, and that was down to 48 by the 3rd of June. So you can see a big drop there. Also, confirmed cases in the ICU, 144 on the 16th of April, 37 on the 3rd of June, and ICU admissions gone from 8 per day down to 1 per day in the same period. So they were the type of figures he gave last night, which did seem to be very reassuring.
What about the concern echoed there by Tony Houlihan in relation to reports of house parties, people gathering in private houses? That's a particular concern because it's a confined space, it's indoors.
That's right. We heard these reassuring numbers and obviously everybody thinking towards the next phase of the restrictions being lifted. But Dr. Houlihan was asked if there was anything in particular he was worried about. And he was very specific about house parties because he said, look, we've all seen the images on social media of parks and beaches and art stations and so on. But a house party is indoors and by definition, people don't necessarily know they're going on other than the people who are there. But clearly they are inside. And that has been an issue all along. I mean, we remember talking about close contacts and being in somebody's company for 2 hours and being within 2 metres of them and so on. Undoubtedly, all that is going to happen at a house party. So it does seem to be particularly worrying. And he said that there was two things people should look out for. First of all, don't organise them. But secondly, if you're invited, then don't go. And again, that echoes something he said earlier in the week, that as these restrictions are lifted, it'll become more on the individual to take care about their own behaviour. As people now have a little bit more freedom to do more things, it's still up to the individual not to put themselves in danger of transmission and to keep an eye on their own particular space. And he said, you will know yourself what a crowded place is and just don't go into it.
Right. So what then about the changes that is expected will be signed off by the Cabinet today, moving to phase two of the government's roadmap for reopening society and reopening the economy. And the plan is laid out, will we understand, be implemented, but there are going to be some further easing of restrictions as well, it's expected.
Yes, that's what's hoped for. We'll know definitely later after Cabinet has met and signed off on the rules. But, you know, NPHET essentially saying last night that, yes, they had given their go ahead. And we know, for example, that people will be able to travel up to 20 kilometres. Up to four people can visit a household for a short period of time. People who are cocooning or taking special care can have a small number of people visit their homes under restrictions. But we're also expecting some larger retail outlets maybe to open than was initially expected if they front onto the road. And we're also expecting to hear measures in relation to children. And this is not a school setting, but possibly playgrounds, possibly summer camps, other initiatives like that. So all will be revealed later, but certainly there is hope that we'll get quite a bit of information.
All right, very good, Sinead Crowley. Thank you very much indeed for that.
And we're joined now by Jean McCabe, who is the Deputy Chairwoman of Retail Excellence Ireland, which represents around 1,600 companies, which employ around 110,000 people. Jean, thanks for joining us on Morning Ireland. As Sinead was saying there, one decision that the Cabinet will make in a few hours' time is whether to allow large shops to open 3 weeks earlier than planned in phase two rather than phase three. That presumably, from your point of view, would be good news.
Yes, absolutely. We really welcome the phase that's been brought forward. Retailers have been closed for quite some time now, over 3 months, so that is definitely good news.
But how many of them will actually be able to open?
That's the question. The shopping centres still remain closed, and if you look at the August 10th phase, you're talking they'll be closed for over 5 months. So as a group, you know, our members have been annoyed that their stores are going to be closed that length of time. And if you consider that what government are asking, they're essentially kind of contrary to their own health advice, condensing, you know, consumers, which there's going to be pent up demand on a smaller retail footprint. So we have been lobbying them to reconsider the opening dates of the shopping centres, to bring them forward and to spread that pent up demand across a larger retail footprint, which would make social distancing much, much easier. What you could have a case now with the stores now start to reopen, people are going to travel to their favourite high street store. You're going to see larger numbers queuing outside stores, and it's going to be harder to maintain that social distancing. So we think it's a better solution to bring forward the dates of shopping centres. 29th of June, for example, by the time 29th of June comes along, the pent-up demand that was initially there will have alleviated a small bit over the next 2 weeks. So by the time shopping centres do get open the 29th, then that pent-up demand will still be existing, so those retailers still have some chance of recouping some of their losses and having some chance at the season, and also ensuring that it's easier to implement the social distancing.
But you can presumably understand from a public health point of view, which is paramount at the moment during a public health emergency, that shopping centres allow for a much greater circulation of people. So at the moment, at least, according to the public health authorities, it's not safe to do that.
I know, and there's a fine line between public health and also our economy, and I suppose we're moving into the next phase of it now, and we just have been urging government that if we are to be erring on some side of possibility that retailers have a chance of the season, imagine being a footwear retailer with a store full of summer sandals and you were watching your competitor sell out his stock for the next 2 months while you remain closed. And some retailers just cannot wait. They have been closed for such a period of time, and there's rumblings that some just won't wait. So we are urging government to reconsider that and bring it back. And it also allows a situation where government can still control the reopening. We just fear that some stores just won't be able to wait that long and will open sooner, contrary to the government's directive. And that if at least it's controlled and the date is in sight and it gives them some chance of the season, I think it'd be much better.
But how many of your members, for example, who aren't in shopping centres, who have access from the street, won't be able to open again simply because they don't have the cash, the available liquidity to open their stores again on Monday?
There is a big liquidity issue. Now, there are some supports there, but they're slowly coming through. A lot of stores are sitting on the timing, actually, for anyone that was in seasonal retail like fashion or footwear. The timing couldn't have been worse for them. March would have been their peak stock hold for deliveries, and it would have been time for payment also. So there's going to be a serious liquidity issue, and I'd say, unfortunately, we're going to see some casualties as a result.
Would you have an estimate at this point, Jean, for how many might not reopen at all?
Not right now, I don't, Audrey. We would estimate, I couldn't tell you, to be honest. I won't estimate that. I don't want to scare anybody.
Do you think that when the shops reopen on Monday, that the custom will be there? Or do you think that people will stick to online shopping for quite a considerable time?
We do think there will be a pent-up demand there. So across Europe, there has been a pent-up demand for the first number of weeks. And we would definitely envisage that, you know, customers will keep it local, will support their local stores, and the impact that that would have on those businesses right now would be greatly appreciated. And to give an example, in Denmark, we're seeing, you know, trading like for like for the first 2 to 3 weeks, or maybe a couple of percent up, and then it alleviates off. And I think that's the piece where the stores in the shopping centre are going to be opening at a period where that pent-up demand will be gone, and recouping any bit of income back is going to be slim. So that's where we're urging government to bring it forward, obviously within line with the public health advice, but to consider that those stores are going to be opening at a time when the economy will be much more sluggish than it is right now.
But it'll be a very changed experience, won't it? I mean, so many people just love shopping. They love browsing. They love going out for the day to shop. And with the prospect of queues, of social distancing, of shops having to steam clothes between them being tried on and jewellery and so on, the fun will be taken out of it.
Yes, it'll be much more functional than when we would know. It won't be as leisurely, but retailers, in fairness, have been quite creative and inventive in ways that they can ensure a safe environment for the customer to shop, but try and maintain some level of that customer experience and that some bit of a personal touch. I think after everyone being, you know, at home for the last 3 months, we're all craving that bit of social interaction, and that can happen in a safe environment as well.
Okay, well, no doubt everyone wishes all your members the best of luck come Monday and in the weeks ahead. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Jean McCabe, Deputy Chairwoman of Retail Excellence Ireland. It's 25 past seven.
The community of Port Magee in South Kerry say they've been left devastated by the decision of the Office of Public Works to close Skellig Michael to visitors for the year due to concerns over COVID-19. Boat trips to the UNESCO World Heritage Site are estimated to be worth up to €8 million per year to the local economy. This report from our Southern editor Pascal Sheehy.
Paul Devan is a boat operator from Port Magee in South Kerry. He has 5 boats, one of which is licensed to land visitors on Skellig Michael, a rocky outcrop 12 kilometres off the Kerry coast. Skellig Michael is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. A monastic settlement dating from the 6th century is still intact at the summit, 200 metres above sea level, while the filming of scenes for 2 recent Star Wars movies has increased its popularity as a visitor attraction. Although the number of people taking day trips to Skellig Michael is tightly controlled, visitor numbers have been increasing steadily, until concerns over the spread of coronavirus forced the Office of Public Works to announce last month that the island would remain closed for the year. Paul Devan says the repercussions of that decision will be felt throughout South Kerry.
Oh, it is massive. Like, this place should be buzzing today now. Like, there should be, I'd say, 300 people going in and out of Skellig here today. Like, 180 they go on the island, but you could have 200 or 300 more that circle the island all day. So, like, it's a spin-off to the shops, for the bars, even the Skellig Experience across the way. It's a massive loss, even all the B&Bs. So they're hopeful that something will come mid-July.
Of the 15 boats licensed to land visitors on Skellig Michael, 13 tie up in Port Magee, a village of around 250 people. The marketing of the Wild Atlantic Way, the arrival of the cast of Star Wars, and the resultant increase in the popularity of trips to Skellig Michael significantly improved the fortunes of the village. But the decision to keep Skellig Michael closed for the year is a huge setback.
Star Wars was a savage help. I'm still say the Wild Atlantic Way, the boosting, the marketing of that was excellent.
Anthony Keating has run Port Magee's Fisherman's Bar and Skellig Restaurant with his wife Mary for almost 2 decades. During peak season, he would normally employ 17 people. This summer, he's looking at employing 4. He questions the decision to close access to Skellig Michael for the year.
Hopefully, the lending on the Skelligs should commence on the 20th of July at the latest, if the cases are as controlled as they are at the moment. You couldn't be in a safer place than on a boat. I'd rather be on a boat going to Skelligs than on a plane going to anywhere. There's definitely no question. It's the safest place. On a good, calm day in Port McGee, heading out to Skellig Michael is the freshest and healthiest place you'll be.
Now, Sir Kathleen.
Mark Conway and his wife Emma run the post office and grocery shop in Port McGee. Mark is one of those who is calling on the Office of Public Works to review its decision.
My reaction was, I suppose, at the time it was the obvious thing to do, and it was the right thing to do and the correct thing to do at the time. My reservation was that the whole season was being written off in the first week of May, which seemed very pessimistic and throwing in the towel, to be honest. I think you could review the situation again maybe on the 1st of July, or maybe even the middle of July, the middle of August, or the 1st of August, and you could get to the 1st of July where there's virtually no cases in the country. So I don't see why it can't be opened, and 90% of the people that will be here will be Irish. So to me, it's a low-risk facility, if not a no-risk facility, you know?
In a statement, the Office of Public Works said due to concerns over the spread of coronavirus, it wasn't feasible to guarantee passenger safety on a mobile, constantly moving platform like a boat, with multiple touch and clutch points. Skellig Michael should have been open to the public from May 15th, but a spokesman said that won't be happening now.
Pascal Sheehy reporting from South Kerry.
Brian Finn is here with our first look at the business headlines. Morning, Brian.
Thanks, Audrey. Good morning. British drug maker AstraZeneca has said it would be able to supply 2 billion doses of a potential coronavirus vaccine after it signed 2 new deals, including one with Bill Gates. The new deals would see it double previous promised production levels. The drug maker has agreed to supply half of the doses to low and middle income countries. The combined wealth of America's billionaires has jumped by around a fifth since the onset of the pandemic. According to the Institute for Policy Studies, US billionaires, including Amazon's Jeff Bezos and Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, saw their wealth climb by over $500 million, mainly due to surging stock prices in those companies, which have benefited from people staying at home. It comes as over 42.5 million American workers filed for unemployment. Borrowing costs for European governments fell yesterday, and the euro got a lift after the European Central Bank announced a 600 billion euro boost to its bond buying programme, bringing it to a total of 1.35 trillion euro. This morning, the euro is trading at $1.13.7 and around 90 pence sterling.
Well, like so many other businesses, various parts of the transport sector are warning that they are on the verge of collapse because of the pandemic. Bus companies, along with chauffeur businesses, want the 14-day quarantine rule lifted at our airports. Cian McCormack has the story this morning. Cian, let's start with the chauffeur and the VIP drivers. Who are they?
Well, we're talking about the chauffeur companies that bring VIPs around the country when they arrive to Ireland. And those VIPs include many A-listers, everyone from Catherine Zeta-Jones to the Pope and many more besides. The Western Chauffeur Drive Association, a network of chauffeur companies all over the country, but more predominantly based on the West Coast, says the industry needs help, or parts of it could go under because of the impact of COVID-19 on tourism. I spoke to 2 members of the association, starting with Mary McGrath of Dublin and Cork-based company Optimum Chauffeur Drives.
We have some of the government contracts, so we would have looked after the papal visit, and we'd also have looked after the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge when they were here. So any of the large state visits that come to Ireland, we would do all the transportation for those. Under normal circumstances, we'd be very busy at this time with conferences and state visits and tours, but obviously because of COVID, that's all been cancelled now. So we don't have drivers working on the road at the moment. Compared to the same period last year, we've seen a 98% loss of business.
Mike Buckley, and I'm Managing Director of Kerry Coaches in Killarney. I've driven Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, and Catherine Zeta-Jones, Michael Douglas, a lot of the Hollywood A-listers have come in with us over the years. We've really had them all, Cian.
What's been the impact of COVID-19 and the pandemic?
The effect has been catastrophic. Midsummer last year, we would have employed 130 people. And at the moment, I'm sitting in an empty office. The full fleet is locked up. 30 to 35% of our fleet would be small vehicles, which would be large Mercedes S-Classes, Audi A8s, small minivans, Mercedes MPVs. Current fleet value is about €7 million, but God alone knows what it'll be worth at the end of this pandemic. To get back into business, we need the incoming tourists to come back to the country. You see, we transport people to the periphery. We bring them to the Wild Atlantic Way. We bring them to North Donegal, down to West Kerry, down to the Wexford coast. And a lot of the tourism businesses on the seafront and on the coast in Ireland are decimated at the moment. And we're the people, we're the conduit to get those people from Dublin Airport to Shannon Airport when they arrive into the regions. And because of our inability to do so, those areas are going to perish as well.
That's Mike Buckley there, and before him, Mary McGrath. Cian, how do they want this issue addressed?
Well, the Western Chauffeur Drive Association says it wants to be part of the government's tourism recovery task force, which was set up to tackle the devastation from COVID-19. It also wants to see more people coming through Irish airports. Here's Fergal Jordan, the association secretary.
We need a continuation of the COVID-19 pandemic payment scheme for our members and employees. They need at least a continuation of the moratorium on bank loans. And very importantly, we need a seat at the table as part of the Tourism Recovery Task Force. A lot of our businesses before this crisis were viable businesses, and they still can play a key role in the recovery in 2021 of tourism. The industry is so reliant on international travel. We will only really recover when international travel resumes. A lot of our members are very concerned about this because a lot of them won't make it to 2021 if they don't get some help in the interim.
That's Fergal Jordan there from the Western Chauffeur Drive Association. Is what he's saying, Cian, does that match what other parts of the industry are saying too?
Yeah, it really does, Audrey, because the National Chauffeur Driver Association is also calling for similar measures. On top of that, the Coach Tourism and Transport Council, which represents coach tour companies, is also concerned about the impact of the pandemic. Here's Kiva Maloney-Kavanagh, a member of the council's executive. She is also the group operations director with Pearse Kavanagh Coaches in Urlingford in County Kilkenny.
We've been annihilated, absolutely annihilated. There's nothing. The diary is blank. Everything is gone. All our tours that were due to go out in up to the end of August have been cancelled. All our incoming tours from our American and Canadian clients are all gone. And they're on the phone now wanting to know what's happening in September. And unfortunately, there's nobody giving us any information that we can pass on to our clients. They need 90 days notice to their hotels, to their clients and to their airlines, whether they're going ahead with their particular program. And unfortunately, with this 14 days quarantine that they've brought in, none of our tours as they stand can go ahead. And unfortunately, the worst part of it is nobody is telling us that 14 days quarantine will disappear with phase 2 or phase 3 or phase 4. We don't know when it'll be gone, and we really need that information in order to try and salvage some part of the 2020 coach tourism season.
Kiva Maloney-Kavanagh there. Well, the Minister for State with responsibility for tourism and sport, Brendan Griffin, says the transport and tourism concerns that we've just heard are being addressed. I spoke to him yesterday, and first I asked him about the calls by the chauffeur and coach groups to be included on the government's Tourism Recovery Task Force.
People are hurting and people are very concerned for the immediate situation and for the future as well. The people that we've heard from play a very important role in Irish tourism in terms of transporting our very valued visitors. They will be consulted with, they will be heard. And again, the task force isn't a group made up of individuals representing sectors. It's a group of experts in Irish tourism who are going to do their best to put in place measures that will attract as many tourists into the country for as long as possible, to spend as much as possible as soon as possible.
Is there any hope that there will be a more definite roadmap for the likes of Caoimhe Maloney Kavanagh, who just needs to know when things will loosen up in terms of international travellers?
I can assure Caoimhe that we are working extremely hard and trying to give as much clarity to people as soon as possible. I mean, I've asked officials within our department to examine best practice in other countries in terms of alternative ways of protecting public health here in Ireland, and yet at the same time trying to optimise the number of visitors that we can attract here.
Addressing some of the issues in the tourism sector there, that was the Minister for State with Responsibility for Tourism, Brendan Griffin, ending that report by Cian McCormick. And on the programme after eight, we'll be talking to the Chief Corporate Affairs Officer with Aer Lingus, who also wants the 14-day quarantine rule lifted at our airports. And we'll be hearing from the Business Minister, Heather Humphreys.
8 minutes and 48 seconds, the length of time police officer Derek Chauvin was filmed kneeling on the neck of African-American man George Floyd, causing his death and prompting worldwide protests. 8 minutes and 48 seconds was the period of silence observed at a memorial service for Mr. Floyd in Minneapolis yesterday, at which mourners were told his death would not be in vain. Four police officers have now been charged in connection with the killing. Former US President Barack Obama has called for a nationwide review of the use of force by police and for progress on police reform. Before we came on air, I spoke to former New York police officer Eugene O'Donnell, now professor of police studies at John Jay College in Chicago. Would he, I asked him, support Barack Obama's call?
A lot of time went by between the time this erupted the last time, which is about 5 years ago, and there's really been no progress. And the president tried to do the best thing they could there, but that report really didn't help, because one of the major questions in the country is where the police going to come from. Police departments all over the country are incredibly short-handed, and you can't get recruits. And even if you lower standards, you still can't get recruits. And we're at a point now where the people who want to be in urban American policing might very well not be the people you'd want to hire.
But in those situations where police are called to a scene, and perhaps there's some requirement for restraint or dealing with a potential disturbance, are they adequately equipped and prepared and trained to deal with that in a way that we don't end up with the sort of situation we saw in relation to George Floyd and this terrible killing?
Well, where we are now at this juncture, after this weekend especially, the formulation now is that in the big cities, is that nothing is worse than a bad outcome with the police. Nothing is more monumental or problematic than a graphic video of the police using force on somebody. And that's a model that cannot be sustained in our country, for sure. And so we're really at a crossroads here we're going to have to reckon with. And there's actually people talking on both sides practically about what you do beyond the police, because you can't define American policing. 350 million people just in New York alone, the 5 million calls a year to the NYPD, guns everywhere, violence everywhere, not everywhere, but concentrated poverty, mm-hmm. and then you have these the knock-on effects of that, and make that the standard. So you essentially have a stand-down of the police in the places where they're most needed. And in cities like Baltimore, you basically don't have a police force at this point.
The issue here, as we can clearly see, is it's who has been subjected to this excessive force. It's African Americans, it's Black Americans, many times more likely than their white counterparts to be the subject of police violence and even killings.
Well, a lot of that actually collapses, that theory, when you actually look at the data, but it's never been a data-driven conversation. And it's, if you look at the proportionality of crime, which is incredibly disproportionate, the police in America would be patrolling, in urban America, would be patrolling some of the most dangerous streets in the world. Urban violence would be incredibly disproportionate. A city like Chicago, which this weekend, unrelated to the looting, had 85 shootings, 24 fatalities. You'd have in this city probably a third of the population is white. You'd have no white victims at all. There'd be no, in 10 years, you'd have no white victims. We've had in Chicago in 25 years, 20,000 African-American kids killed, and it's almost always cross-racial. And so if you're doing data-driven policing, all of your resources are going to be in the poorest places. And that, just on the face of it, is an invitation for disproportionality. I'm by no means suggesting that there's not issues here. There's a lot of complicated issues. But you may remember the last bad shooting in Minneapolis was an African officer shot a white Australian woman. Mm. So we have a aggressive culture, a violent culture, a gun culture. The cities have a homicide culture, and people die when the police act, but far more people die when the police don't act. That gets no attention.
What about President Trump's response to all of this? His calls to dominate the streets, using police to clear very often peaceful protests. What effect is that having on relations between the police and the community?
It's an extraordinarily, there's no words to describe how inappropriate his conduct has been repeatedly, but this is a new low, and it's really triggering. Unfortunately, I think we're going to have a constitutional crisis over something that's really minor in the scheme of things, which is to say that he wants to send an army in against looters. I was in Philly last weekend. Many of the looters are just kids. We don't need the army to come in on that. This is an indictment of the political system. But, when I talk to the cops, who, sadly, at this point, because everything's so polarized, are big Trump people, they have to admit that the worst thing you can be in as a police officer is to have a loud mouth, know-nothing, provokative, no-skin-in-the-game commander, egging people on. But fortunately, most recently, the military establishment in the country is really rising to the occasion and, is refusing to be dragged into, a crisis over something that should have been solved politically and could be solved in a much, much less dramatic fashion.
Do you think, just finally, Eugene O'Donnell, anything is going to change as a result of this, as a result of these demonstrations, the public outcry?
Well, it's a worrying time. I'm not going to deny it's a worrying time, because I believe that the conversation is getting narrower, and it's a much, much larger conversation. It's devolving onto the shoulders of the police, and the police are going to just not have. The police are going to have a much. They already do. And going back to your question, the police. If you go to urban America, it's very hard to get arrested in urban America at the moment. So the use of forces. Use of force, their footprint in poor neighborhoods is virtually non-existent. So policing has been reformed to the extent that there's a whole lot less of it. But the demands, it's impossible to keep up with the demands. So the no police force will, certainly in our country, will be able to be in urban America and have this set of demands. Again, a profession where you can't even get people into the job. Who would want to be a police officer in urban America?
Former New York police officer and now lecturer in police studies in Chicago, Eugene O'Donnell, speaking to us a little earlier. Time for our business news this morning with Brian Finn. Morning, Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Good morning. Well, we're joined on the line this morning by Mark Redmond, the CEO of the American Chamber of Commerce in Ireland, to talk to us about the role of foreign and US investment in particular in any economic recovery here. Before that, Mark, just to refer back to that previous item, I'd like to get your view on the protests around race and the use of force by police in the US. Is it time for the government to take an official stance with the ambassador, perhaps, regardless of our strong trading relationship?
Well, good morning, Brian, and thanks for having me on this morning. I think I feel two things about what's happening in the United States. First of all, I'm absolutely heartbroken that one of Ireland's closest friends that has stood by us in our darkest hours is going through such anguish. And that country inspired Ireland to build a rules-based democracy governed by consent. But also, I feel very importantly, Brian, that Ireland is on a similar journey to the United States. We're becoming a more diverse society, where one out of six kids are born to non-Irish parents, and where 120,000 people from 180 countries have taken out Irish citizenship. I think it's really important that Ireland recognises that every day our fellow citizens are experiencing racism here.
So no matter what you look like, no matter who you love, no matter what you believe, anyone who's in Ireland should feel they belong here. They should feel they're at home.
Just looking ahead to the economic recovery and the role that foreign investment might play, is it perhaps a bit of an ask this time round, given that every economy is in the same boat pretty much, and the UN is forecasting a contraction of up to 40% in global foreign investment?
Well, Brian, it's an ask Ireland absolutely has to make of the multinational sector here. And today we're launching our report, Make the Bridge Stronger, which is about the extraordinary role multinationals and the Irish operations of multinationals play in our economy and our society. And during this pandemic, the 160,000 talented women and men that work for multinationals here in Ireland have shown they can be relied on to keep global supply chains in medtech, in pharma, in microprocessors, data, financial services going. And just to underline the importance to Ireland, Brian, in the last year we have statistics. The multinationals here invested 10 billion in payroll, 6.3 billion in supplies from Irish SMEs, and 5.3 billion in capital expenditure. Multinationals are critical to Ireland's economic recovery, and in our report, we're setting out a roadmap how to ensure Ireland really treasures and cherishes what multinationals bring to our society and our economy.
And you mentioned pharmaceutical production there, and we know of Donald Trump's desire to bring production back to the US. He's mentioned Ireland as a target on a number of occasions. Could that be a big problem if he gets re-elected and pursues his protectionist stance with perhaps more vigour?
So, Brian, it's a great question. And in fact, in our report, we explain why diversified global supply chains are critical to the global economy and to global health and well-being. And in fact, they're far better than the protectionist alternative. And indeed, in the United States, we're seeing right now, and this is set out in our report, how protectionist domestic supply chains aren't standing up in the face of the pandemic. You need to have diversified global supply chains if you want to have the best answer for patients suffering from critical disease, if you want to have the best answer to solving the awful pandemic gripping our globe. Global supply chains are the best way to address that pandemic.
Mark Redmond, CEO of the American Chamber of Commerce, thanks very much indeed for talking to us this morning. More business news at 8:30. Audrey.
It's time for the weather forecast for the weekend ahead. Andrew Doran Sherlock is at Met Erin. Morning, Andrew.
Thank you, Audrey, and good morning from Met Erin. Well, our weather is going to remain cool and unsettled for the weekend, with rain early in the week, but current indications are that temperatures will pick up again afterwards. So for this morning, showers are crossing the country from the north and northwest, but there are some bright intervals too. The day is shaping up to be rather cool and blustery, with a mix of sunny spells and widespread showers. Some of these will be heavy, possibly thundery, and there is a risk of hail too. Highs of 11 to 13 degrees in Ulster and North Connacht, with 13 to 16 degrees elsewhere, warmest along southern coastal areas. Winds will be mostly moderate to fresh northwesterly today, but strong on exposed coasts, especially around Ulster and Connacht. The winds will increase into tonight, becoming fresh to strong, with gales on northern and northwestern coasts. It'll become cloudy in the north tonight as well, ahead of persistent rain moving in, which will become widespread in the northern half of the country. It'll hold mostly dry further south, but cloud will increase towards dawn. Cool tonight, with lows of 5 to 7 degrees. Tomorrow morning, the rain will be heavy in the northern half of the country, but becoming lighter as it spreads further south. Still very windy, with fresh to strong northwesterly winds. The rain will clear to showers during the day, but still staying generally quite dull. The winds will ease a bit, becoming mostly moderate to fresh. Highs tomorrow of 12 to 15 degrees generally, but cooler along northern and western coasts, and potentially even a bit higher along eastern and southern coasts. Sunday will be a generally dry day, with some sunny spells to start with, but longer spells of sunshine will develop later in the southern half of the country. Again, it will be cooler in the north and northwest, with highs of 11 to 14 degrees, and 15 to 18 degrees elsewhere, in light to moderate northerly breezes. So to recap for today, cool and breezy with widespread showers. That's the forecast. Thank you and have a great morning.
You're listening to Morning Ireland on Friday the 5th of June. The news at 8 is read now by Susan Jackson.
The Cabinet is meeting at 10 o'clock this morning to decide whether or not to move to Phase 2 of the government's roadmap for easing COVID-19 restrictions on Monday. Under Phase 2, the travel limit would increase from 5 to 20 kilometres and up to 4 people could visit another household for a short period of time. Marts, libraries and retail outlets would be allowed to reopen their doors so long as certain social distancing measures were met. The Minister for Health, Simon Harris, said last night that all the indicators look very good for such decisions to be taken. Our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham.
Minister Harris said, hopefully the Cabinet will be able to take a series of decisions today which will bring big benefits to everyone in Irish society. He said this was based on encouraging signs, such as the low reproductive rate of the COVID-19 virus, which is less than one, and the lower levels of hospitalisation. Under Phase 2, the travel limit would increase from 5 to 20 kilometres. Up to 4 people could visit another household for a short period of time. People over 70 could also have a small number of people visit their homes. Minister Harris said that while it wasn't a position anyone in government wanted to find themselves in, he had to stress that social distancing is still followed during house visits so people don't make each other accidentally sick. He said a small number of additional measures were likely to be passed. These are understood to be the opening of playgrounds, kids' summer camps, and also the opening of big retail outlets with access onto streets. Minister Harris appealed to people to continue to be responsible as shops reopen, saying, just because a shop returns, it doesn't mean we all have to go there at the same time.
The spread of the COVID-19 virus remains a cause of concern as issues around the contact tracing systems have arisen. It's been confirmed that up to 40% of close contacts of confirmed COVID-19 cases in meat plants have not been notified. The Minister for Health, Simon Harris, confirmed the figure during a debate in the Dáil yesterday. Our Agriculture and Consumer Affairs correspondent, Fran McNulty.
In the last 7 days, there were 123 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in meat factories. That's more than one third of all confirmed cases. During a debate last night, Minister Simon Harris said contact and communication difficulties meant only 60 to 70% of close contacts of confirmed cases in meat plants had been contacted. That means that the close contacts of 300 to 400 people haven't been contacted at all. Independent TD Dennis Nocton told the Dáil last night what had been revealed by the minister posed what he called a significant community risk. There have been 1,048 confirmed cases in meat factories, 27 workers were hospitalised. RTE News is aware that some meat companies are now retesting staff and will plan to do so every few weeks. But despite efforts to curb the spread, in the meat industry, COVID-19 remains a serious issue.
Captains of industry in Northern Ireland are calling for a delay to the implementation of regulations on goods transported from Great Britain under the Brexit withdrawal agreement. The customs and regulatory formalities known as the Irish Protocol are due to come into effect on the 1st of January. A consortium of Northern Ireland business groups has urged the UK and the EU to postpone introduction of the measures for 6 months, warning of company closures, delays at ports and a decline in consumer choice. Our Europe editor, Tony Connolly.
The Northern Ireland Business Brexit Working Group brings together virtually every stakeholder in the northern economy. Its report is an urgent cry for more detail from the British government on how it intends to implement the protocol and for what it calls generosity of spirit from the European Commission in applying the rules. The consortium says that companies cannot start training staff on new customs formalities until London spells out exactly how the new regime will work. And the longer that goes on, the longer what the consortium calls an adjustment period will need to be. The Business Network says an enhanced trusted trader scheme is needed so that consignments bound for supermarkets can undergo much more streamlined customs and food safety procedures. Tony Connolly, RTE News, Brussels.
For the 10th consecutive day, demonstrators have taken to the streets of cities across the United States to protest against the death of the African-American man George Floyd in police custody. A memorial service has been held in Minneapolis, the city where he died. The Reverend Al Sharpton delivered the eulogy in which he called for an end to systemic racism in the United States.
What happened?
happened to Floyd happens every day in this country, in education, in health services, and in every area of American life. It's time for us to stand up in George's name and say, get your knee off our necks.
The authorities in Germany are awaiting a response to an appeal made yesterday for information about the disappearance of the three-year-old English girl Madeleine McCann in Portugal 13 years ago. Prosecutors in Germany say they're investigating a jailed sex offender for her murder. In an interview on Primetime last night, Clarence Mitchell, a spokesman for the McCann family, made this appeal to people in Ireland who were in the Algarve around the time of Madeleine's disappearance.
Please rack your memory, look at all the information the police have put out, it's all over the media now, and see, do you have any photographs that might be of use to the police? Anything, no matter how minor it may seem, anybody that was in the Algarve in May 2007, and just before that, in fact, might have some vital piece of information that could still help the police to build a case against this man, if indeed he is involved.
And the time is coming up to 8 minutes past 8.
RTE Radio 1 weather with SuperValu. Home cooking is more important than ever lately, so get inspired with thousands of tasty recipes on supervalu.ie.
It'll be cool and blustery today with sunny spells and showers. The showers will generally be in the north and west, but will become widespread. Some will be heavy and possibly thundery. Highest temperatures will range from 11 to 13 degrees in Ulster and North Connacht, and from 13 to 16 degrees elsewhere. And there's a warning that northwest winds will reach gale force 8 this evening and tonight on coastal waters from Sligenhead to Mallonhead to Strangford and on the North Irish Sea.
Angus Cox is back with what it says in the papers.
Lockdown gamble as stores set to open 3 weeks early. That's the main headline on the front of the Irish Independent. The paper says the Cabinet is expected to sign off on a major acceleration of the government roadmap for easing restrictions after the National Public Health Emergency Team gave the green light to allow major retail outlets with on-street entrances to reopen from Monday. Under phase two of the plan, only small retail outlets were due to open next week. The Cabinet is also expected to sign off on an extension to the temporary wage subsidy scheme until the end of the summer. That's according to the Irish Times. It's reporting the special COVID-19 unemployment payment is also set to be extended until the end of August and that it will be split into two bands, with those earning less than €200 receiving €203, while people earning above €200 would get the current €350 weekly payment. The Irish Examiner says a 1947 law could be used to tackle lockdown house parties after Chief Medical Officer Tony Houlihan expressed concerns about such gatherings. According to the paper, the concern follows a tense confrontation in Cork City yesterday between two men and the occupants of a house where there was clear evidence of a recent house party. The house on Glasheen Road is close to where residents first raised complaints last weekend about what they described as Magaluf and J1 style house parties in the area. The paper quotes trainee solicitor Sarah McNulty, who says the Health Act of 1947 creates a general legal duty to take precautions against infecting others with disease and gives health officials the power to enter any premises to investigate suspected breaches. Up to 700 jobs are to go at two firms in Northern Ireland due to the pandemic lockdown, according to the Belfast Telegraph. Margaret Canning's article says Portadown aircraft seating producer Thompson Aero Seating is cutting up to 500 jobs as a direct result of the impact COVID-19 restrictions have had on air travel. In addition, she says 200 out of 1,100 jobs are at risk at 42 Charles Hurst dealerships as new cars sales plummet. Yesterday was pictures of Madeleine McCann featuring prominently on the front pages. Today it's the prime suspect in her 2007 disappearance. The Irish Sun reports police homed in on the man who has a history of child sex abuse after he told someone in a pub he had snatched her, while the Irish Daily Mail says the suspect had been on the police radar for more than two decades. Analysis of government formation talks across titles focuses on the potential role of independent TDs. In the Irish Independent, Hugh O'Connell writes Michael Lowry and Fiona Murphy are among a group of regional independents who are open to backing a coalition. While in a comment piece in the same paper, John Downing says it was Jackie Healy-Ray who created the template for independence to make the most of a government deal through the concessions he gained for Kerry by agreeing to back the Fianna Fáil Progressive Democrat coalition in 1997. There's a call for urgency with regard to the conclusion of talks in the editorial in the Times. It highlights the need for the Oireachtas to pass important votes on criminal laws and COVID supports by the end of June, adding the country needs a government with a mandate and it needs one immediately. The talking has gone on for long enough, it concludes. Finally, to the Examiner, where Owen English tells the story of the Cork boy who has been hailed a hero by the President for raising €26,000 for charity. 7-year-old Oliver Lynch from Ballincollig has cerebral palsy and epilepsy, but that hasn't stopped him from making the most of the lockdown. Having set himself a target to walk 5,000 metres during lockdown, Oliver has been doing 100 metres in his walking frame every day for the past 2 weeks, and in doing so has raised funds for three charities that help him: Enable Ireland, Dogs for the Disabled and the CUH charity. Some days it takes him 40 minutes to complete the walk. And in a personal letter delivered to Oliver's home yesterday, President Higgins praised his efforts, writing, "There can be no doubt that you are one of life's great heroes." Dad Kevin says Oliver was looking at the letter all day with his mouth wide open.
Well, congratulations to him. I think I'm among those perhaps who should take a leaf out of his book and try and get a bit of exercise at the moment, but well done to him. The next steps in reopening the country, extending the distance for non-essential travel, allowing greater social contacts, reopening shops will be decided by the Cabinet today as we move to phase two of the government's COVID-19 roadmap. The National Public Health Emergency Team has given the go-ahead for a further relaxation of restrictions following a continued decline in the number of new cases of infection and data suggesting that the R number, the reproduction rate of the virus, remains between 0.4 and 0.7. But speaking last night, the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, warned of the risks associated with people moving ahead of public health advice when it comes to easing restrictions.
It is really genuinely dangerous. So, I mean, what we try to do with our public health advice is government has asked, you know, NPHET consistently, tell us what is safe to do. And that's what NPHET does. They advise us, the Irish people, what is actually safe to do. How do we get back to normal, a new normal, and how do we do it in a way that doesn't risk our health, or that certainly mitigates and minimises those risks? How do we learn a way of living alongside the virus? And believe me, if we thought it was safe to do something over there tomorrow, we'd do it. So I would hope that people would realise that and I don't mean to sound kind of trite when I say this, but we are actually all in it together. If you decide, or I decide in my own life, to start getting ahead of the public health advice and getting ahead of the government decisions and trying to do something from phase three or phase four and phase two, what you actually do is jeopardise the potential to move forward with the plan.
Minister for Health Simon Harris. Well, one restriction that remains in place is the requirement that people arriving in this country isolate for 14 days to ensure they are free of the infection. The government's public health experts say the restriction should stay for the moment. The Taoiseach, though, hinted at a possible relaxation, saying yesterday he hopes that international air travel could resume in the first instance with air bridges to countries which have suppressed the virus to the same extent as we have in Ireland. Let's talk now to Donal Moriarty, who is Chief Corporate Affairs Officer with Aer Lingus. A very good morning to you, Donal, and thank you for taking our call this morning. Just first of all, to give us a sense of the impact of this 14-day quarantine on your own business, on Aer Lingus, what's its effect on travel into and out of this country?
Well, it has a number of effects. It obviously has a deterrent on inbound travel into Ireland, because any tourism travel that would be inclined to come to Ireland will obviously be deterred by the fact that they would have to quarantine for a period of 14 days. Similarly, in terms of outbound travel, it has a significant deterrent on that, because those returning to Ireland, home to Ireland, would then have an obligation to quarantine for 14 days. So it essentially affects both ends of every route, and therefore has a very significant deterrent.
At the moment you're operating, I think, is it something of the order of 10% of your normal schedule? How big a factor is the 14-day requirement in that?
It's actually less than that, Brian. It's approximately 5% of our normal schedule. The quarantine period is a significant factor in that, but the broader travel advisory, which is an advisory against non-essential international travel, also has an impact. Across Europe, there is a phase developing where travel is being opened up. Mm-hmm. Other member states in the European Union have taken steps in recent weeks to announce the timing of their reopening of travel. And it's interesting that most of that travel is now going to commence in the month of June, and at the latest by the 1st of July.
What then would you like to, in Aer Lingus, like to see in relation to this, particularly the 14-day requirement?
Well, we think the government should urgently review its travel advisories generally and outline its plan and timing for the easing of travel restrictions and the lifting of the 14-day quarantine period. They have a strong basis upon which to do that, given that the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control and the European Aviation Safety Agency issued a protocol on the 20th of May regarding travel in the COVID-19 context. Mm-hmm. And on the basis of that, the European Commission has invited member states to progressively restore transport services and connectivity. And that's exactly what's happening in other European member states.
But we all know that different countries are at different stages in relation to their dealing with this virus. And we heard Simon Harris say there in relation to various restrictions, you know, if we could ease them, we would do it, he says. But their advice is for the moment that this 14-day quarantine should remain in place.
Yeah, well, Ireland's success in suppressing the spread of COVID-19 is at a level that is equivalent to other member states within the European Union. Those other member states are relying on the advice of the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, and they're now taking steps to ease travel restrictions, to promote inbound tourism, and to eliminate any quarantine requirements. So Ireland is a significant outlier in its outlining of its plans to ease these restrictions. That has happened largely across the European Union, and Ireland is virtually standing alone in not having addressed that issue at this point.
Mm. Airlines such as yours obviously are facing a very serious crisis at the moment, and there have been pay cuts and in other airlines announcements of redundancies. In the case of Aer Lingus, 50%, and now a further cut to 30% of normal pay for your staff. Even though there is access for your company, as there is for all companies, to the temporary wage scheme, which is designed to maintain pay levels for staff.
Yeah, no, the wage subsidy scheme has been welcome, but its contribution only represents a fraction of our cash outgoings on a monthly basis. And we need to remember that this is the greatest crisis that the airline industry has ever faced, and it will take a number of years to recover from it. And unfortunately, we've had to reduce working hours and pay up to and including layoffs, because we've had to align our resources with the work that needs to be done. And Aer Lingus will inevitably be a smaller airline with fewer employees when we emerge from this crisis. I suppose the important point in that regard is that the government has within its power to make decisions that will lessen the impact of that crisis on the airline and on its employees, if it provides the clarity on removal of travel restrictions and the lifting of quarantines. Okay. That will generate demand for services, which in turn will allow us to put on more services, and which in turn will mean that there'll be more work for our employees.
All right, Donal Moriarty of Aer Lingus, thank you very much for that. 22 minutes past 8.
We're joined now by the Minister for Business, Enterprise and Innovation, Heather Humphreys. Minister, good morning.
Good morning, Audrey, and good morning to your listeners.
And you heard there, Donal Moriarty. We also spoke to people involved in the tourism sector earlier in the programme who are really desperate for information about when the travel restrictions will ease. When are you going to outline your plan and your timetable to do that?
Well, firstly, I just want to acknowledge how difficult it is at the moment for companies like Aer Lingus and indeed all airlines and the staff who are affected by cuts. This is obviously a challenging time for everyone involved. The virus has no mercy, and that's why we have had to introduce these restrictions to save lives and ultimately minimise the damage to the economy in the long run. Secondly, I'd say that we are behind other countries in terms of the stage we're at with the virus, and that's why there's differences between us and other EU countries. That said, the Taoiseach confirmed yesterday that as the world returns to a new normal, we're planning to reintroduce international air travel through air bridges. And this would mean arranging deals with countries that have flattened the curve to a similar level as we have. So we'd be looking at lifting travel restrictions if people are flying to and from countries where the virus has been successfully suppressed. So this is weeks away and it's far too early for anyone to book holidays yet. But I want to be clear that we have plans in place and we will activate them as soon as it is safe to do so. So it is continually under review.
We also spoke to Retail Excellence Ireland because the Cabinet is meeting in an hour and a half's time to approve the Phase 2 reopening. They're happy that larger retail stores may be allowed to open on Monday, but they're unhappy that those in shopping centres can't. She said that there are rumblings that some will open anyway. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, all of these issues are up for discussion at Cabinet today, and I don't want to preempt the discussions later. I fully understand the concerns of the retailers in shopping centres. I understand the points they are making, and I have been engaging with them, and obviously I will be making the case for them. But of course, on the other side of things, there is a public health concern around people congregating in confined spaces. Maybe we can look at mitigating measures that we can take to deal with that. But again, it's all up for discussion today.
But if shops within shopping centres open without approval from Cabinet, will they be closed?
Well, can I just say that, businesses have cooperated with government throughout this, and I would expect that they would continue to do so. And by doing so, they made sacrifices, but it has also meant that we've been able to get this virus under control.
Do you have an estimate for the number of businesses who will not reopen at all simply because they don't have the cash on hand to keep their business going?
Well, I don't have that figure, but what I do want to say is that for any small retail business opening up on Monday, there are two things they should do straight away today. Apply for the government's restart grant. That's a minimum grant of €2,000 and a maximum of €10,000. Go to your local authority website today. It's a simple one-line page application. And that's a direct cash grant into your bank account. The second thing they should do is get on the wage subsidy scheme. A lot of small retailers might only have 5 or 6 staff and they might have opted to go on the pandemic unemployment payment. From Monday, if those businesses' turnover has been 25% impacted by COVID, which I'm very sure it has been, they can get on the wage subsidy scheme. And that's essentially a grant from government to pay for up to 85% of your staff wages, and that's that immediately frees up cash flow for other areas. And then there's a range of other supports, but those are the two things I would say to businesses to do before they open on Monday.
The pandemic unemployment payment being paid to over 540,000 people now at €350 a week, it's due to run out on Monday. Will people on that benefit, will they hear today of whatever changes are coming?
Yes, that will be discussed at Cabinet today. And as it stands, the pandemic unemployment payment expires on the 8th of June. But a government decision on extending the scheme will be made this morning. What I can say is that it will be extended for months, not weeks. And nobody who was working full-time before the pandemic will see their pub cut. It will stay at €350 per week for those who are working full-time prior to the pandemic hitting. And of course, there are anomalies in the scheme. They're well documented. And the example has been given that somebody who was working a couple of hours on a Saturday and then they were entitled to get the full €350. Of course, we know that's not sustainable, and there will be some changes in that. For example,
so will part-time workers who, at the moment, or at least, sorry, who pre-COVID, who were earning less than €200 a week, will their PUP be reduced to the unemployment rate of €203?
Yeah, well, that will be discussed at Cabinet. But what I can say is that part-time workers will not be worse off than they are now.
And will that change come into effect immediately from Monday?
The changes are due to come in. I just can't give you the exact date. They're coming in. As I say, we'll discuss it at Cabinet. But what I can say is that part-time workers will be no worse off than they were before they went on, than when they were working.
Will the message from government, as we've known it for the last number of months, stay at home, will that be replaced by stay local?
Absolutely. What I would say is Stay local, shop local and shop safe. This is a great opportunity for people to support their local businesses, and I would encourage them to use their local shops, because those shops, some of them have remained open during the pandemic. They have obviously incurred additional costs, and they have really been frontline workers, and we saw how the supermarkets have remained open and they have done so very successfully. And I would say to the people, continue to stay and support your local shops.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us. The Minister for Business, Enterprise and Innovation, Heather Humphreys.
Around half of Irish businesses surveyed by Morgan McKinley said they don't believe they will return to pre-COVID levels of activity before next year at the earliest. The Global Recruiter spoke to over 250 firms across Ireland and the UK. Just 15% of Irish respondents said they were confident of returning to pre-crisis levels by the end of this year. They were mainly in manufacturing. Around half of companies said they had seen a fall in revenue of at least 20% since restrictions were introduced. Commercial property investor Yewgrove REIT says it's collected 97% of rent due for the second quarter. That exceeded its expectations. It says it's agreed temporary rent deferral on around 2% of the balance. The remaining percent is due from non-food retail outlets mainly, which are expected to reopen soon. European stock markets opened higher as investors digest the promise by the European Central Bank to expand its bond buying by as much as 600 billion euro in an attempt to cap government borrowing costs. The euro also got a boost. This morning it's trading at $1.136 and 89.8 pence sterling.
And it's good morning to Darren Frehill.
And a very good morning to you as well, Audrey. And some big news this morning, because RTE Sport understands that the GAA will announce plans of their return to play protocol around about 5 o'clock later on today. And the news is good for club and inter-county teams this year. The plan obviously will all be very dependent on the health situation and the government giving everything the green light. But after weeks and weeks of uncertainty, we have some light at the end of the tunnel. And to tell us about that light, here's Damien Lawler.
It's a landmark day for the GAA as it unveils its return to playing roadmap at 5 o'clock this evening. The plan will be revealed 2 hours after phase three of the government roadmap is laid out. All future proposals are dependent on government advice and instructions, but right now the outlook is promising and hopes are high that club and inter-county championships can be played this season. October has always been suggested as a starting point for inter-county championships, and it's understood that remains the case. It's also believed that club championships could start at the end of July or early August. Phase 2 commences on Monday, and that sees walking tracks open for recreational use. Phase 3 is significant. That happens on June the 29th, and already it's been signalled that GAA pitches could be open by then. But there will be much change along the way. Teams will start back non-contact training and splitting into different pods. Consent must be given for underage players to resume activity. Equipment must be washed and sanitised at the end of every session. And clubs will be expected to appoint a COVID supervisor. So a lot of hard work lies ahead, but this roadmap does offer much hope of a GAA season after all.
Yes, interesting developments there from Damien Lawler. And in terms of what that all means, well, at 5 o'clock this afternoon, the GAA expected to make that announcement. Club action expected to return, a championship maybe in August and September, Audrey. And then the one, I guess, all of us throughout the country were kind of looking forward to was the possibility of an inter-county championship coming up in October and November. And we're pretty excited about that.
What do you think, Darren? Is it possible? I mean, it's such a contact sport. It's hard to see how it can be done safely.
No, absolutely. And look, that is the big reservation, isn't it? And I've spoken to a number of players and they have reservations over the last couple of weeks about making any return while COVID-19 was in the public domain. A lot of these guys, they live with elderly parents, elderly grandparents, and they do have reservations about coming back. But I think given what's happened over the last couple of weeks, Audrey, the health situation does seem to be improving. And again, as Damien said in his report, this plan is all very dependent on the government giving everything the green light. They're going to monitor this situation. It's going to be a lot of hard work, but the GAA, as well as monitoring the situation, will be taking every precaution. I think this plan is going to be a movable object. It might evolve as time goes on, as we tick towards the return of the club championship and also the inter-county championship. They'll take a lot of precaution health-wise, but also in terms of facilities. No details yet on the structure of the championship or where these games will be played and whether or not they'll be played behind closed doors. But I think as time goes on, this is going to be something that evolves.
Well, that's the thing. And I suppose they are looking at experiences as matches restart across Europe. I mean, the Premiership across the water is starting within the next couple of weeks. It has already restarted in Germany. Are you there, Darren? I think Darren's gone. We were just getting started in our chat. I was talking to you there, Darren, just about them watching the experience across Europe as matches and sports events resume.
Yeah, well, I think what's been really interesting has been, you know, and we've been covering it a bit over the last couple of weeks, the return of the Bundesliga. And they were the ones, in terms of team sports, that took the big step forward, weren't they? And I think the world was watching. And I know the games are being played behind closed doors. Some of the matches, you know, can be a bit soulless. I know German TV is piping in sound effects and all that to help the atmosphere. But I think we've all been watching with interest, and it's happened pretty seamlessly. And again, they're taking huge precautions. And again, the caveat here is they are professional. The GAA is amateur, but given the situation we're in, and you know, I think a lot of this is dependent as well on the government announcement this afternoon. But when you can see, you know, the high street shops opening again and playgrounds opening again, why not, you know, get the GAA championships back again? And I think it would give not only, you know, great entertainment and sport for us down the line, but also give the nation a huge lift as well. So,
oh, there's no question
I think
about
all
that.
Systems go.
Yeah, and testing though, Darren, because the other sports, and I know as you say they're professional and they can afford to test, will the GAA test?
Oh, I'm sure they will. Now, there's obviously huge expense with all of that, but it's worth noting one of the big test centres is actually in Croke Park. And again, this is just pure speculation, but I could see all of the championship games, certainly in inter-county situation, take place at just a handful of grounds, so maybe two or three grounds, and that they're able to police it a lot better. The League of Ireland is testing, and the League of Ireland doesn't have the resources that, say, the big professional leagues, the Premier League and the Bundesliga have. And they've had, it's been a test situation. They've tested four different clubs in the League of Ireland over the last couple of weeks. And so far, so good. All negative tests, which has been really good. So I think the GAA will take heart from that as well.
Well, we shall all be listening very closely this evening, Darren. Thanks a million. Darren Frehel there with that sports update. 8:41.
Well, are we moving more slowly than needs be to easing COVID-19 restrictions? Could there be a greater relaxation in the next phase of reopening the economy and our society, as some business and tourism interests are asking, and as we've been hearing earlier in this programme? Well, this morning, the Cabinet, as we know, will meet to decide on easing travel, social and shopping restrictions based on a recommendation from the National Public Health Emergency Team. Ministers are expected to sanction phase two of the government roadmap, with some further measures such as reopening some large shops being brought forward in all likelihood. Well, Paul Moyna is Professor of Immunology at Maynooth University. He joins us on the line now. A very good morning to you, Paul. We wanted to talk to you really to get a sense of where we are in relation to our understanding of this virus and our progress in suppressing it, particularly in the context of many voices saying, really, asking the question, are we moving more slowly than we could be? Are we a bit slow or about right, do you think, in terms of reopening the economy and our society and our social interaction?
So first of all, we're doing really well in terms of suppressing the virus. In terms of pace of exiting lockdown, I would say we're probably on the slow side and like ultra cautious side. So certainly if I look in terms of lockdown and what lockdown has achieved, it appears as though lockdown has achieved quite a lot. But I think quite a lot of the effectiveness was due to the restrictions that were put in place before the lockdown of 28th of March. So At that time, I certainly think lockdown was the right thing to do because cases were getting out of control, the viral transmission was getting out of control, ICUs were building up, and we didn't really have a choice. And we didn't really have much data to go on, apart from looking at dreadful scenes in Italy. But now we're in the lucky position, we can look back and we look at the data and begin to look to see at what restrictions actually worked. And certainly when I look at the data, there isn't a very strong evidence base to suggest that the full lockdown that was effective from the 28th of March had a meaningful, had a major effect. Most of the benefit seemed to have come from the restrictions in place beforehand. So certainly, I think we have probably some scope in terms of speeding up the exit from lockdown and move to a more, I guess, targeted, informed and smarter approach as we exit that lockdown phase.
And what about our understanding of the way the virus is transmitted, and particularly, and there is data, I think, to support this released by NPHET in the course of its briefings, the concentration of clusters in particular locations in, we know what happened in nursing homes, for example, but also in particular workplaces.
Yeah, so as you say, we're learning more and more about the virus, and especially in terms of how the virus is transmitted. So in the last number of weeks, like three independent approaches have shown that basically the transmission of this virus is not even across all infected individuals. So most individuals, even though they're infected, don't transmit it on. And in fact, we're looking at situations where maybe 80% of the transmission is done by maybe 10% of the infected individuals, and that leads to this clustering type effect. So we tend to see that in situations, close contact, inside, poorly ventilated areas. That's typically where most of this transmission takes place. So we end up with clusters like in nursing homes, care homes, meat factories, hospitals. But I think we need to take that information now into account and let that inform policy. So in terms of moving out of lockdown, because of this clustering type effect, we can be more targeted and smarter in terms of how we move out of lockdown. And that really involves testing and tracing and being able to identify these clusters, identify them really, really early and do the contact tracing.
And who are
so
those?
That's something we really need to focus on.
Who are those 10%, I suppose? And what about some specifics? The 14-day travel requirement here, that people coming into the country or coming back to the country would self-isolate for 14 days. Is that necessary?
Yeah, so ideally it is, because it obviously curtails the additional seeding within the country again. But again, we have to look at all these situations and evaluate the level of risk and then see if we can mitigate that risk. So certainly I heard the minister this morning in terms of indicating that maybe there will be some plans and partnerships with countries that have equally suppressed the viral transmission. So I think that's something positive. So again, it's looking at the risk, identifying the risk and figuring out how we can mitigate that risk as much as possible.
We expect the travel restriction for non-essential travel from home to go to 20 kilometres from Monday onto this next phase. But could the move towards travelling outside your region, could that happen sooner than as is currently planned in July?
Yeah, I'm not so sure in terms of, the difference between 5, 20 kilometres. It's more important in terms of when you get to your destination, the type of activity you're involved in. So in terms of, moving beyond the distance of 5 to 20, I don't think that's very important, but I do think it's very important in terms of what activity you engage in when you get to your destination. So I'd focus more on that and in terms of doing the risk analysis around that, because we know now in terms of that it's transmitted at really close quarters, more inside than outside. So with that in mind, I would make sure that allows us to determine policy.
So really, if I hear you correctly, what you're saying, the emphasis really should be, and maybe increasingly will be, on individual behaviour, individual responsibility.
Individual behaviour is really, really important, both in terms of social distancing, but also even in terms of testing. Like, it's really, really important in terms of when people have symptoms that, again, they look for a test immediately. And it's really important then that nationally we have a testing and tracing system that works very effectively. So there's responsibilities at various levels, from individual society level, but right down in terms of at state level, in terms of putting in place those structures to make sure that we can exit lockdown in a safe manner. And if those structures are in place, I think we can safely exit and more quickly than we're doing currently.
Paul, once again, we appreciate as ever your time. Thanks for talking to us. That was Paul Moyna from Maynooth University.
Now, the annual Summer Ladies' Day at Navan Racecourse will not be going ahead tomorrow in its usual form, as you might have imagined, but that will not put a stop to women all over Ireland from entering the competition. It will go ahead online, and proceeds will go to two local charities. Elise Sheehy reports.
Mike, so did you get back to the sponsors, or did they contact you? I did. I spoke to three of them. So
fashion bloggers Paul Carroll and his partner Mike McCarthy making final preparations for the Navan Racecourse virtual Summer Ladies' Day tomorrow. The personal stylists are well accustomed to judging Ladies' Day at the races. Entries will be accepted between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. tomorrow, and the winner will be announced on social media at 7 p.m. Mike has this advice for those who would like to take part.
Donations can be from €5 upwards, and all you have to do is take a photo of yourself in your outfit, make your donation and take a screenshot of it, send it through on the Instagram stories or through Facebook, and just tag Navan Racecourses and Funky Fashion Frolics. But most importantly, they'll be supporting two great charities in Meath Women's Refuge and Meath River Rescue.
And while it's all about the look, Paul says personality is just as important.
What we're looking for is a lady to really portray her personality through her own individual style in that photograph. Normally on a race course, if we see the same lady and it catches both our eye, we think, yeah, she's in.
It's uncanny the amount of times we both come back and said, oh my God, it's her.
Yeah, and usually that will be the lady that will end up in the winner's enclosure at the end of the day. We're looking for the same, but just virtually through a photograph. Be a bit quirky, be a bit fun. We need a bit of fun now, don't we?
Meath Women's Refuge is one of the charities that will benefit from the fundraising event. They operate a helpline which is manned 24 hours a day, all year round. They also provide emergency refuge accommodation to women and children who have to leave their home due to domestic abuse. Support worker Imelda Fallon says the charity has experienced a surge in demand over the last number of months.
We've seen 13 referrals for refuge in March, but in April we've had 33 and in May we've had 36. In terms of our helpline in the month of March, we dealt with 152 calls coming in and going out on behalf of women. But in the month of May, this went up to 404 calls. Again, more than double the numbers.
So this is a 1950s vintage dress, and it was made by a designer, Julie Caulfield, from Wexford. To match the dress,
in Dublin, Mary O'Halloran sees Virtual Ladies' Day as a form of escapism from the realities of COVID-19 and, in a way, returning to some form of normality, even just for a day.
We all really need that hit of dressing up and just looking at the photographs and keeping our interest alive, because, you know, these couple of months will pass. And hopefully again we'll all be there physically with each other. But for the moment, Virtual Ladies' Day, I suppose, is a good substitute. And then you have the charity element, and we've two really good charities.
Yeah. Wow, you're going higher than me.
Back in Meath, mum of three, Tina Halpany from Wilkinstown, will be taking some well-deserved time off tomorrow to spruce herself up for the virtual charity event. Her outfit is ready and she is under starter's orders.
I've a couple of goonies in the wardrobe. There's one favourite. It's a River Island floral dress. Even if it is sitting here in my back garden with the birds singing and maybe a glass of wine or maybe a gin and tonic, sure, I can just pretend I'm here at the races. It will be a whole new, different experience. Previous years, it's all about meeting up with your friends and, admiring the style and admiring the hairdos. I mean, it's a special occasion. Being a mother of three kids, I don't get the opportunity to do that often. So I'll be doing my own hair and makeup for this Saturday. I don't know how it'll look, but I have the dress and I have the heels.
So you're good to go. Tina Halpany from Wilkinstown in County Meath ending that report on Ladies' Day at the Navan Racecourse tomorrow, going ahead slightly differently, as you might expect. Ellie Sheehy was reporting there.
46 students from Limerick and Galway have composed their own song as part of an outreach programme organised by the Whistle Blast Quartet. The initiative is designed to introduce children and young people from a range of different backgrounds to the world of music. The song is entitled Then We'll Meet Again. It's available online. The proceeds go to Childline. We can listen to a little of the song now.
When we've seen this through to the end, then we'll meet again. Then we'll meet again.
Last night, two of the students involved, Yegbe Oseyemin and Amy McAllister, spoke to our reporter Killian Sherlock about what's involved in making music at a distance.
My name is Yegbe Oseyemin and I'm 15 years old. I attend Dominican College, Taylor's Hill. I've been singing for as long as I can remember, really. It's just always been in me, I guess. I've always been interested in singing. My whole family are kind of really musical.
I'm Amy McAllister. I'm 14 and I go to Laurel Hill Cloister in Limerick. And I started playing the violin when I was around 6. I'm in the National Youth Orchestra of Ireland.
It was really nice creative process. Everyone had an input in the song and it was really nice process. And it was so amazing because childhood is a really important cause.
We all recorded individually at home a video and then they got it all together and put them all together to make the one video, which came out so good at the end.
This shows the importance of music and how it can have an impact in today's society.
The final product, like, it made me so happy. And like listening to it, it was like we were all together just playing. It just felt so good to like be playing with people again, especially when you can like help people. And like we've raised stuff for like such a good cause. And
two of the students involved in the production, we can talk to Mary Curran of the Whistle Blast Quartet. She's the French horn player. Mary, thanks very much indeed for talking to us this morning.
Good morning, Brian.
Now, this was something that actually was underway before the pandemic struck, isn't that right?
It was indeed Whistle Blast Quartet, who's made up of obviously four of us, myself on French horn and Conor Linehan on piano, Kenneth Edge on saxes and clarinets, and Una Kyo. We've been running a composition program for many years, actually, but this particular year, we were working with 200 students all over Ireland, including special needs mainstream students and youth orchestras, and we were actually composing with up to 200 students the day that the schools closed. So we kind of had to all just get in our cars and go home. But of course, we like to work and we like to keep in touch with our wonderful students. It was great to hear them there. They really are so talented and they are so innovative and expressive. So we decided, let's not let this opportunity go by. Let's find a way of getting a good portion of the students together. Mm-hmm. To actually do an online project. Let's continue doing a part of this project.
So there was obviously the recording was done online. You're all in your separate locations.
Yes.
But actually, you still had to work on the composition. Is that right? Even before you got to that stage.
Well, when we were on the day of lockdown in Galway, those students had mostly written that song at that stage and had come up with all their own ideas. And of course, Conor used his magic to put all the ideas together and conjure up a really coherent melody for the song that they had written. He drew all their own ideas together. So it was so relevant to the present situation that we decided to slightly change a couple of things in the song mm-hmm. to make it fit into the present situation. And then we coordinated the whole project, getting in touch with all the students and getting mm-hmm. them to record individually at home,
200.
Putting it into a Dropbox. And then we put the whole thing together into the online performance, which is on our website, whistleblastquartet.com.
But you were working here, May, with 200 students, which is a large number in the room with you, never mind trying to operate with them in that kind of remote way.
Well, under normal circumstances, we actually work with groups of about 30 at mm-hmm. a time. So when we go to all the different locations in Ireland, we work with a particular group and they kind of write their own composition and then we have a common composition for them all to put together. So in this particular instance, we zoomed in on the Galway group and the youth orchestra Kiol na Mara because the youth orchestra would be playing with all the different groups in the final performance. We've just had all our concerts cancelled in the last 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. So we would normally be bringing all the 200 students together to different venues around Ireland to perform to the general public. So, of course, we couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. However, we are planning to do that as soon as we can.
Yeah, and hopefully that will be sooner yeah. rather than later. And maybe some of the news this morning gives us all a little bit of heart that things might be getting back to normal or some sort of normality. Just we're close on time, Mary. Just very quickly again, on the website, the song is downloadable
yes.
from... quickly
please,
again?
Please go to whistleblastquartet.com and you can download the video there and donate to Childline.
Excellent.
And you can see all the other projects we're involved in. Thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you very much for your time. Congratulations on a wonderful project.
Mary,
that was Mary Curran from the Whistleblast Quartet. Just 2 minutes to 9.